Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
A world without borders, wouldn't that be amazing? Every day I get messages from people asking about how to get a visa to America, to China, to Hong Kong, to here, to there, all this visa stuff. And then there's the banking questions about what's required to get a bank account here and there, and set up questions for companies and taxes in this country and taxes in that country, corporate taxes, personal taxes. You know, I think maybe we're a little bit ahead of the curve, listeners, and myself included, but isn't this stuff kind of getting a little bit irrelevant? Okay, guys, so happy Tuesday morning, and a world without borders, or borderless. Today's topic is a fascinating one for me and most likely for you, because you're listening to this podcast, Global from Asia, where we are talking about doing business anywhere in the world, no matter where you're born or where your passport's from. So it's also one behind the event, you know, cross-border summit's coming up in less than 2 months now, and we're going to be talking about a lot of these borderless things too. So let's talk about this week's show. We have Tak Lo. He is newly come back to Hong Kong, and he's rocking the startup community, making connections. He's been making me a lot of intros too, and he has a lot to share with us today about the borderless economy coming from Hong Kong. So let's listen in. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We have with us Tak Lo. He's still, I'd say, new to, or welcome back, you know, to Hong Kong and Asia, right? A few months now?
Yes, it's only been 2 months.
Okay, cool. So let's just do a little brief intro. You are, you know, a startup Ronin, as I read, a thinker, teacher, and advisor. You were previously director at Techstars in London with their inception, and worked with over 40 cross-cultural companies around the globe, and 6 years across Asia, Europe, and New York communities and startups and angel investing. So it's really a pleasure to have you on the show, Tak. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So how does it feel to be in Hong Kong after the past couple of months?
Yeah, it feels a bit weird because I'm actually originally from Hong Kong. So I left Hong Kong when I was about seven. And so coming back feels a bit weird because, you know, I know a lot about Hong Kong. You know, I came back almost every single year. So I know a lot about Hong Kong, but I literally have no friends. All I have is just family. And yeah, so that's kind of a bit weird. And on the ecosystem, the startup ecosystem side, it's definitely early, no question. But there's seriously a lot of very interesting things that are sprouting up here. And I think that's the non-weird part. That's the exciting part. That's the interesting part.
Yeah, we met through Jeff Brewer, and he connected us, and it was nice to meet you and get you here. So I've been catching up on your blog, which is really, really a recommend. We'll link in the show notes. And basically, I think we're going to talk today about borderless from Hong Kong. You spent some time, I read on your blog, in Japan in December at a conference, and you're saying, like, which I do agree with, and I think listeners also are excited about, is this whole borderless economy. Can you maybe define that really a little bit?
Yeah. The way I think about it, and I wrote a piece, I think it was called Tokyo and the Borderless Economy. And I wrote a piece about it. And the way I think about it is essentially kind of reducing friction to doing business across. At first, what I was thinking about was Asia. And then obviously, I think kind of worldwide as well. So rather than a Hong Kong startup scene or Singapore startup scene, the way I think about it is an Asian startup ecosystem, European startup ecosystem, US startup ecosystem. And then to some degree, at some vision, is to have entire digital economy startup ecosystem connected. That's fairly independent of, I think, the processes and legacy processes and barriers of the old economy. So yeah, that's kind of how I think about it.
Got it. Yeah, I think, and yeah, we'll link the blog post on the show so people can read it in detail. But I saw you had like four main parts of this economy, like the ideas, the human capital, the IP, and the financial. So I don't know if you're ready, we can dig into those points, or?
Sure. Yeah, let's definitely do that. So I don't remember all four off the top of my head, but actually, Michael, if you can prompt me, that would be awesome.
Okay, sure. So I will go through. The first one was you were talking about ideas and the idea that, you know, like maybe you can expand on that point or.
Yeah. So ideas are if you think about borderless, ideas are relatively borderless now, right? So I think prana hunt is a great surfacer of that, or a great kind of exhibition of that, right? So ideas are now being exhibited and shown all across the world, and you have ideas from extremely early stage to extremely late stage. If you take a look at Hacker News as well, certain ideas are surfacing on there as well. So there's Reddit. There's a lot of mediums for these ideas that come through. I think also what's helped is, you know, English being kind of the de facto start language and everyone gaining a very good kind of fluency in English really helps. So ideas are, in many degrees, I think, already borderless. Already borderless and already being surfaced in the right way in the right channels.
Okay. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but a lot of people are always nervous of their ideas being stolen. I'm sure you've heard that all the time. Usually it's a newbie entrepreneur, but of course, if they put their ideas out there and it becomes really hot, I mean, it's still about execution, right? I mean, how do you connect like idea to business or to startup?
Yeah, no, that's definitely how I think about it. So I think most people think about it. So you're totally right. I think newbie entrepreneurs oftentimes kind of fear that. But the way I kind of parse it is the fact that I think the tangible benefits that you get from being, so it's all about execution, not a question, but the tangible benefits of being open outweigh the negatives. That's the way I think about it, and that's the way I explain it. But being more open, you actually stress test. It's an open system now. So you stress test your idea, and it actually improves. You improve your ability to partner in business development because you just increase the nodes of connections between your idea and other people's ideas and other people's connections. And three, you're able to enlist other people to help, right? So being open net, I feel has a lot more positives than just execution, than just simply saying execution is a lot. It's all about execution rather than the idea. I think you really tangibly increase your idea's ability to be an actual product if you're more open to it. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, that's really great. I think that helps because that's still something I hear quite a lot in startup communities and, you know, online. So I like the node. I'm kind of visualizing nodes. So like, yeah, your information's going out there and people are coming back with feedback and you're becoming a bigger and bigger node as you share more.
Yeah. And it's, you know, there's, you know, I'm a big believer and a big reader of the OODA loop. Which is a military decision-making framework. So OODA stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act. And so kind of a big part of what the OODA kind of stipulates is the fact that, you know, it has this kind of thing of being an open system and a closed system. And closed systems ultimately die, and open systems ultimately win because they're able to get feedback, iterate, improve, get more feedback, and iterate, improve. And so I think the more open you are, the more you're able to get that feedback and the faster you're able to create these OODA loops to be able to build a product, get to market faster, and be able to satisfy customer needs faster than if you're a closed loop. And it's a binary decision. You're either one or the other, right? You're either open or closed. So, you know, that's the theoretical backing of why I think it's important to be open.
Cool. I agree with you, although everybody's probably still nervous sometimes with, you know, especially being in Asia with mainland China, this kind of history of, you know, of somewhat being pretty fast to execute. And
that's no question, right? I mean, I've talked to a lot of people in China, and it's very interesting. You know, one investor Richard Chan from Iron Fire Ventures here in Hong Kong said to me, and this is really interesting. Western startups do this. They build and they fail fast and they move to the next one. Asian startups or Chinese startups more specifically, multivariate test. So they like do 50 different tests and see which one sticks, and then they focus on the two or three or the one that succeed, right? Or trending upwards. And so, you know, I think to your point, I think That's true. I think the copying tactic is popular still in the mainland China. I think it has a higher risk of being copied. But I ultimately still believe in the first philosophy of being focused, extremely focused, and building on one kind of idea and going from there. Because you just reach very deep insight on your product and the customer need. And so I think despite the market here in mainland China, and my advice for founders is despite that market, despite the copying risk, I think the focus that you have and the deep insight that you receive about your customers will still ultimately win, is my deep belief. Now, you might not win in mainland China, and I think that's a different market and that's a different context altogether, but I think you will ultimately win in the larger ecosystem, if you will.
Cool. Yeah, I agree. Agree totally. So let's go to your next point here, which I think is going to be a fun one for listeners, is the human capital, the free flow. Yeah. You mentioned Estonia e-residency is a point. So maybe first kind of what the idea of human capital is.
Yeah, human capital, right? So I was an econ major, so a lot of these things are kind of framed in that context. So human capital is really, if you take a look at ideas, right? And, you know, we've already experienced kind of free flow of ideas. And the internet has really helped kind of proliferate and kind of spread and distribute ideas all across, and source, right, ideas from all across the world. But I think human capital is still relatively fixed by legacy kind of systems and barriers. So human capital is in kind of visas to get from place to place, travel restrictions, those type of logistical kind of barriers. I think we're passionate about the Estonian e-residency program. Yep. So I hold a U.S. passport. And so U.S. passport has significant upside in the sense to be able to travel in a lot of different countries. In Canada and Australia are, I think, the top three. But there are some other unfortunate kind of passport holders that don't necessarily have the same freedom, if you will. And I think there are also certain countries that the U.S. passport really isn't as friendly. And so I think being able to not destroy it, but kind of create a new system with the Estonian e-residency program is important. So I'm an advisor to the Estonian e-residency program. What it is essentially the first digital identity backed by a government. And it's not held, and it's not fixed to actually whether you're born in Estonia or you're a resident of Estonia. You can be a resident of UK, you can be a resident of anywhere, but you're an e-resident of Estonia. And so if you think about that one particular micro thought, right, and extend it out to what it could be, anyone could be an e-resident, and therefore everyone, and they're currently building apps on top of being an e-resident, right? So pretty soon you'll be able to open bank accounts in Estonia without ever stepping foot in Estonia, but just by the simple fact of that you have e-residency. You can pay taxes, corporate taxes, by simply by the fact of being an e-resident. And if you take the logical next step after that, other governments see this capability and say, well, look, like this works, it's encrypted, it's secure, why don't we start doing it? And the other governments would actually back digital identities as well, digital identities of both the citizens and maybe non-citizens as well. And therefore, you have a new economy of digitally verified, government-backed, digitally verified identities of the people. And therefore, you can open up bank accounts through this identity. You can apply for visas through this identity. And we will not be fixed. We will not be as fixed as we once were to kind of our passports and our nationalities. And I think we will achieve, I think, one more step in this kind of borderless economy. Now, obviously, I think travel and visa restrictions still could hold, but I think this is the first step to get to there.
Cool. I'm sure there's people have a lot of questions about this. I was almost tempted to make this the full show, but I think, well, we're both American passport, U.S. passport holders. I don't want to put you in a spot. I mean, should we or I? I mean, how should somebody decide to get it, or can they get it, or is it conflicting what they already have?
Nope. I think everyone should get it. And the reason is, look, tactically, you know, there's not much you can do on the platform right now. You can only sign documents and it's verified by Estonia. But it's kind of like a Kickstarter project in the sense they're running not-for-profit. They're running this program as an experiment. And this is the first government that's done it. So definitely help the project. It's 100 euros to get an identity card And you do have to get, you have to send a copy of your passport photo. So you can be US citizen, you can be Chinese citizen, you can hold any nationality. And this, the ability for them to give you an ES or an EU residency is independent of whatever passport you have.
Okay, pretty cool. I think I will do it. I'll follow up with you after and tell you how it goes.
Awesome.
Cool. And next point, intellectual property. Intellectual capital.
Yep. Okay. Intellectual capital has a lot to do with ideas, but I think it's more kind of a higher order level of capital in a sense. So right now, I think we have a lot of ideas. I think labor can actually kind of fix people moving around. Intellectual capital, I think, is more in my take of things, people that kind of know how to build startups, people who know how to build businesses, and being able to impart that wisdom all across. So you start seeing that movement through nomadic mentors, right? So there's a movement called just about 2 months ago that started with nomadic mentors with, so essentially a bunch of Silicon Valley mentors said, look, we have excess time. We're very willing to help out and build that other ecosystem all across the world. And so they're willing to travel or Skype or et cetera, whatever that may be. And the way I think about it is being able to spread how to build businesses, how to be entrepreneurs to other ecosystems in the world. And I think we fundamentally do that. You know, there's a counterpoint to this, which is, you know, I heard this yesterday, is, well, you know, is this the way to build businesses? Is this a very American way of building businesses? And is this wrong to have only one way to build kind of an entrepreneurial business? And my response to that is, I know there's a bit of a tangent, but I hear this criticism. I don't think there's actually one way to build a business. And when I was in London, you know, it was never, oh, this is American style of investing or American style of building a business. It was, this is the way to build a business with whatever resources are available and whatever constraints there are right now. And so I think it's important to share resources and IP across ecosystems and not just from the US as well. The very successful businesses built in Europe. SoundCloud was built from Europe. CityMapper was built from Europe. The Rocket guys, right?
Yeah, they're
built a business from Europe as well. And so be able to import this IP and this intellectual capital and share these best practices, I think, are key.
Yeah. So then maybe I'll try to summarize in my layman non-economic terms is knowledge being shared anywhere in the world, because you mentioned like Skype and Google Hangouts. We're even doing this podcast on Skype right now, so we're practicing this, right? And we have put this online, and anybody can listen to this, learn. So that's the main idea, is like sharing knowledge online between borders.
Sure, sharing knowledge online, whether it's physically of people moving around and being kind of nomadic mentors, or tools like Skype and Hangouts. And just being able to, I think that's a good way to summarize it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, my more primitive thought process.
No, and that's good.
And then financial capital, which is, of course, always what everybody's always thinking about, is, you know, there's always this excuse some maybe we call it entrepreneurs have, is like, I need investment before I can start, but of course, money is important. Getting access to capital is important. So maybe you can share a little bit about how you've seen that develop in this borderless
economy. Yeah. So financial capital. So it's funny, like in the US, so, you know, I've tried to understand and try to kind of think about it. In the US, capital tends to focus very much on cities. And so Boston has a very, very vibrant kind of venture scene and angel scene. San Fran, LA, and it's very micro, so it's very community-based. You might have some East Coast investors that invest up and down the East Coast, but that's a bit of an anomaly. If you take a look at capital in the US, it's very, very city-focused. In Europe, the reason why that is, I think, is because, you know, the grassroots startup ecosystem has been built throughout time, and there's enough of a critical mass of startups, so that investors don't really have to venture out of the city. And investors want to be hands-on, so therefore, you know, it's local. It's localized. In Europe, I think it's a little bit different. I think the development of capital happened a little bit before or in conjunction with the startup scene. So there was never a critical mass of startups that, let's say, in London. So there was a bit in London, there was a bit in Cambridge, there was a bit in Oxford, there was a bit in Berlin, there was a bit in Paris, there was a bit in Stockholm. So the capitalists had to kind of travel to these particular cities and be able to invest. I think also the capital tended to be harbored in London rather than some of the other cities, just because London's a better financial capital, more stable, better tax laws to be able to handle that. So a lot of investors tend to travel a lot more and a lot more frequently to be able to hunt deals across Europe. And what I find interesting about Asia is it's still very US focused. So Hong Kong is relatively looking inside Hong Kong and around Hong Kong. Korean startups tend to be very focused with Korean investors, et cetera, across the different communities. Singapore is probably the only anomaly. So Singaporean investors normally look at Singapore, but throughout Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam. And I think what's interesting, the trend that I see in Asia is at some point, and it's increasingly starting to look like this, investors are looking beyond their own borders. So Hong Kong investors increasingly, Fresco Capital, for example, Mind Fund, for example, looks to the U.S., looks to across Asia, looks at Europe for deals. And the feedback I've been getting is on the Japanese investor side and the Korean investor side is they're also looking to invest in deals outside. The challenge is I think there's relatively high friction for money to flow outside a particular system. So in Korea, there are certain capital restrictions. In China, obviously, there are capital restrictions as well. So I think that's the particular challenge. How we solve that, I think, is the issue. I think AngelList is a great platform to be able to host deals, to be able to invest quickly. But it still doesn't always necessarily address the particulars of each country and the particular nuances on how to get money out of a certain country to the particular startups that need it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not currently in a venture raising capital, but I've been through the process, and a lot of times I still feel like investors are more comfortable being able to like walk to the startup or you know, like within a local, you know, area. I mean, when a lot of people saying like in San Francisco, in the Valley, if you want to raise, you have to be there or have somebody on your team there. I don't know if that's still true. That was just a couple of years ago for me, but I don't know what or some people are saying like go there at least every few months and, you know, just physically going there. You know, it's still kind of hard to build relationships online and get into the community without going to the events and having your coffee meetings and you know, lunches. I still think you need that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or what do you think?
I agree. I think you still kind of need that. I think the only thing, the point I disagree is you have to be in Silicon Valley. I don't think so. I think that model has been deflated. I think on the early stage of capital side, so the angel side, the Series A side, I think if you get to the larger rounds, it does help to be in the US and be in the Valley, but I don't think that's necessarily true. I know that's not true in Europe. In Asia, I think it still is true. But to your larger point of being local and having investors be around to help, that's true regardless. And I think that's true as you get kind of to the early stage of capital, right? I mean, angel investors do want to be hands-on and help, right? And in fact, you want them to be around and help. Obviously, there's a big trade-off between managing investors and between having your investors and having your investors manage you. But I think it's definitely true and a good thing to have good investors around.
Sure. I mean, there's always that saying like, you know, you want smart money, not just
right.
money. You want to have an investor or backers that are helpful and can add value to the business.
Yep, totally.
Cool. Okay. So that covers those four points. But, you know, I think we're talking today about Borderless from Hong Kong. And before we started recording, we had a little bit of some pretty good discussion. And so we're both, I think, on the same side. I'm always preaching, you know, global business from Hong Kong and you know, getting a company, bank account. And, you know, I know lots of listeners are in Thailand, Philippines, or Taiwan, mainland China, even on Europe side, US side, or, you know, South, even guys in Chile. And so, but, you know, they're all buying into this Hong Kong is a good place for your global business. And, yeah, I mean,
bollocks.
We want to,
that's bollocks. No. Okay. All right. Michael, you've been telling the wrong advice. No, I think Hong Kong is great for different things, and I'll be totally honest with the listeners. So my take on Hong Kong is it sucks for currently for startup infrastructure. No question. It's too expensive. It takes too long, especially if you're not a Hong Kong resident. I think there's just a lot of different barriers. However, saying that, it's probably slightly better than better than some of the other economies in Asia, right? So I don't know how it's like to open a bank account in mainland China, but I think operating a business in mainland China definitely has its kind of different risks. I think opening up a bank account in Korea is very difficult. In Tokyo, Japan is very difficult. Singapore is probably slightly easier. So that's one. It definitely has to improve. But if you can sort that out, and I'm currently... That's one of my passion projects, to be able to make that change in the next year, hopefully, to be able to for startups to be able to build and start the business in Hong Kong much quicker, much more easily, much more cost effectively, because Hong Kong is not going to be a startup unless we solve that problem. But from everything else, right? If you think from a scaling perspective, from a infrastructure perspective, doing business perspective, not starting, doing business, Hong Kong's great. The connectivity is awesome. I can be on subway and doing Skype calls, and the connectivity is great. The city is relatively wired for 24-hour business, right? I can get food options relatively quickly. The transport options are relatively plentiful until the wee hours of the night. The transportation link between the airport to city is great, and airport out to many connections all throughout Asia and to the rest of the world is relatively good as well. So the connectivity in doing business is there. It's English speaking. I can get to China relatively quickly right now. There's a high-speed rail that's supposed to be completed by the next couple of years, I believe, if not this year. That will go to Shenzhen and Dongguan in relatively short amount of time. So the connectivity to China is also there as well. So that's great. So doing business in Hong Kong is great. Starting up in Hong Kong, not necessarily great, but within the context of Asia, probably better than many of the other options.
Yeah, I mean, like mainland China is not so easy for foreigners, non-local Chinese, we've looked around a lot of different places, but there's more merchant accounts. We got to get Stripe here. I'm getting begged like all the time. I get emails all the time for Stripe, but Braintree is here. And there's more and more fintech startups in Hong Kong, and it's getting pretty hot around the world too. So, yeah, I really think it's really just a matter of the banking is everywhere in the world. I think, well, I think there's just governments and regulators that are also kind of doing it on purpose. They don't want it to be so easy. Or
yeah, that's true. And Patrick Hollison, if you're listening, yes, please get Stripe here. We talked to Techstars in London. I give you a shirt. I've never wear it. But yes, please get Stripe over here. Yeah, I definitely think it's asinine. I think the banking infrastructure in Hong Kong, the monopoly is definitely makes it harder for people, and intentionally so, because they can't, right? Because where else are you going to go? So that's unfortunate. And what I like to see is new technology and new disruptive models be able to break that monopoly, because it's not fair for people to have, even locals to have, was it 3,000, no, 5,000, I think, Hong Kong dollars minimum to start a bank account, to start a corporate bank account, even though you have the right, you have an invoice, you have a contract, you have the right credentials. It still takes you 4 to 5 weeks, someone quoted me, to start a corporate bank account.
Yeah, man, it's crazy.
It's imbecilic. It's imbecilic. And not to mention just the crummy, crappy, shitty web interfaces, right? Mobile, the mobile banking is terrible. It's absolutely terrible, yeah. Right? And the thing that I'm with, I can't name names, but they don't even have an internet portal.
Wow.
And everything's done by checks here, right? Because it's just old school. So, I'm not painting a very good picture of Hong Kong, but I guess what I'm trying to say is there are certain realities of Hong Kong which are absolutely shitty. And that's what I hope to improve on. And if any listeners have any ideas or want to work on something in this space,
definitely, man. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I guess with challenge, there's opportunity, right? Or problems creates opportunity. So
yeah, what was that word? The Chinese word, the Japanese word for challenge is opportunity.
Yeah.
But I think, I think that's a true, that's true. But I think as entrepreneurs, and assume everyone on the show are entrepreneurs, we tend to think of problems to solve, right?
Yeah.
And we're just locked in on making the world better. And that's the way I look at it. Stop complaining and make stuff happen.
Exactly. Just get
stuff complain done. Less. Yeah, complain less.
Exactly. Cool. All right. Well, I really appreciate your time today. We got a lot here. So you've a little bit about your current direction with your work. So I was reading Monk Mode is over. So Monk, that's a pretty, I was reading into Monk Mode. So you got something new going. You want to tell everybody what you're up to?
Sure. Yeah. So Monk Mode is definitely over. So Monk Mode was a way for me to withdraw and work on actually, honestly, myself. So I read a lot on OODA loop stuff, work on home, right? So moving house and all that shenanigans. And so I'm a venture partner at Mind Fund, which is a Hong-based a venture fund / studio. So kind of like a BetaWorks model. And we have some fantastic portfolio companies, Mixably, Xnotes, Hummingbird Innovations, that I'm hoping to help and fundraise for the next couple of months. And then I'm also an advisor for the ESONY residency program. So that keeps me busy. I definitely have a couple of updates in the next couple of weeks. I'm keeping my hands busy with other things and other projects. You know, I think so. One thing I'll give a hint to listeners, depending on when this is released, the timing might be right or might not be right.
So it's a few weeks from now.
A few weeks. Okay, so it'd be late. So I think, you know, there's been a lot of huff and puff about accelerators, right? And if you take a look at what Sam Altman said, you know, he didn't say don't apply to anybody else. He said if you want to get in YC, right, apply to YC. That's factually what he said. And I think that's true. And everyone's extrapolated what he said to an accelerator dad, or, you know, you shouldn't apply to accelerators, and et cetera, et cetera. That's just a bunch of bollocks. Accelerators are here to stay. It's like democracy. Everyone complains about democracy as a form of government, but it's still the best form of government. And so accelerators are the best models to engage the early stage ecosystem. Unless we find a new model that works, and honestly, I haven't, and I haven't seen anything yet, it's here to stay, and it's only going to proliferate in early stage ecosystems, in corporate accelerator models, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm still passionate about accelerators as a model, and so one of my roles is to be able to expand that concept across Asia, because I still think there are still ecosystems that are relatively early in Asia that definitely needs the model.
Awesome. I look forward to hearing more. And so for people that want to, you know, contact you online, read about what you're up to.
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter at @tac_LO. My email's at tac@taclo.co. That's taclo.co. Please get in touch. Try to be very accessible. Love to kind of hear what your thoughts are.
Great. Thanks again. I'm sure listeners are going to enjoy this one. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael. All right. Cheers.
Thanks, Hawk, for coming on and sharing. I learned a lot during the show, and I didn't even know he was doing his e-Estonia residency thing, which is pretty awesome, and I'm still working on applying. I'm going to try my best to be borderless. You know, I think I'm living on a border constantly back and forth. Today I'm recording this in Hong Kong, and maybe when you're listening to it, I'm in Shenzhen. So, you know, in working time, someone to work with, you know, I don't want to look at where they're from or what their passport is or where they were born or where they went to school. It's actually something I'm kind of arguing a lot with my wife a little bit about. Maybe Chinese have a different idea about education degrees. But, you know, for me, when I'm looking to work with a new client or team member or supplier, I don't look at where, you know, where they're from. I look about, you know, what their track record is, what they've executed, what they can get done. And, you know, I think that's a trend from what I hear. A lot of people, or maybe it's just because I'm in this digital nomad bubble, but I wonder what you guys think. You know, is borderless possible in our lifetime? It seems like it's going in that direction. You know, I'm working pretty closely in this world with companies set up and banking and visas and everything like that. So I might be getting better some places, hopefully. So thanks again for listening to the Global from Asia podcast. We have actually a few iTunes reviews, and I want to make sure I read them. So I'm going to pick another one for this week. We kind of got a bunch at one time. It was awesome. So it's from the U.S. On February 2nd, 5 stars, Omar Abu. And he says, resourceful and super fun. I love everything Michael produces, from his blogs to his ebooks to the podcast. Every time I read or listen to Michael's content, I come out feeling more knowledgeable and ready to get back into the hustle of doing business with my Chinese counterparts. Excellent podcast. Highly recommend. Wow. Thank you, Omar. And you'll have your real name on iTunes. So more power to you. It's not some funky user ID. So it's pretty cool too. And thanks again. So that's all I have for this week, everybody. Keep up the hustle. Keep up the border hopping, crossing, border breaking, borderless world. Peace.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.